Oh, hey, before we start the show, let me just mention that Mythic Bastionland is written by Chris McDowell with amazing art by Alex Sorensen, and you can find more information about the game at bastionland.com. The Smiling Fox, on the other side, is very much an unofficial fan project, a podcast by fans for fans. And in any case, you shouldn't trust the Smiling Fox. He's kind of a dodgy fella.
Welcome to the Smiling Fox, a Mythic Bastionland podcast. My name is Horst.
I am Brian.
Hey, I'm William.
And once upon a time, which sounds like a fairy tale and is also the topic of our show, time, once upon a time, we had a very special guest, a paragon of the Bastionland server, a dabbler in mythic magic, and also an awesome creator of the visual representation of the calendar. I bring you Jesse.
Hello, hello.
All right, so our topic today is time, and my first question is, what is your favorite seasonal event?
Oh man, this is a good one. I am a huge sucker for Elder Mass because I can always make some nonsense happen that the knights will not encounter for like at least a couple of days. It will have ramifications throughout the realms. Yeah, Elder Mass is great. It's so much fun that you can just slowly trickle out to the players.
Have the players ever actually visited Elder Mass?
They did once. I did a one-off not too long ago, and the players were summoned to Elder Mass and then teleported to a cursed realm. So it was the closest they ever got, and it was only like, that awkward thing when you're like at a company meeting and you're on the outside and all the CEOs are on the inside. It's like that kind of conference sort of vibe.
And Brian, what is your favorite one?
I'm going to go with Scepter Mass, where the leaders of other holdings have to come and pledge their loyalty to at the seat of power, because it gives a lot of potential for the tensions. If you've been building up tensions across the realm, to bring them to the fore. And for me, it was like a kind of a countdown. We need to solve a problem before Scepter Mass, because if someone doesn't show up, then it's a big deal.
And William, I know that you focus on one shots, but have seasonal events come up in your game? And if not, which is the one that you're most excited about?
I kind of like came up with my own idea for one of my one shots where it was the end of summer leading into winter, and the villagers were kind of like boarding up their windows and chopping down parts of the forest for firewood to endure through the winter. And at the same time, the Wyvern was eating their livestock. So it added a bit of flavor, but as is kind of expected for one shot, I don't have a lot of time to flesh out a lot of that stuff if my players aren't like diving into it.
And Jesse, you mentioned Elder Mass, and I think that would have been probably my last pick or my least favorite pick, just because, just as you said, it happens somewhere in the background, and then whatever they decide percolates into the realm. Whereas I like the things when the players are actually there. So I'm running at the moment a player post of Scepter Mass, which is an absolute bloodbath of betrayal, backstabbing, machinations, and so forth. Then there are the beginning of the season events, like the Feast of the Sun. My favorite is the Feast of the Stars, where you have the tournaments. And then there are the end of season events that haven't really come up in my game. Did it feature in any of your guys' games? The Tithe and the Levy.
Not really. We've kind of had that thing happen where like players will start early on in a season And then, you know, a couple of weeks into it, they'll be like, okay, we've done enough. It's time to skip. So typically the ending stuff doesn't show up usually unless they make an effort to like, no, we really need to get this done before winter's done or spring or whatever.
There's probably a bit of a built-in bias towards the start of season events, I think, because you tend to skip forward. So I haven't actually seen Tithe or Levy happen.
I think Tithe was like, we did like a media res thing of it when winter passed, because some folks got curious about the calendar and were like, oh, I see that this event is going on. I think this is the thing I would have paid attention to during that time period. We had one character who was like researching a way to turn monster meat into protein to make milk shakes for the general like vassals and stuff to feed them through the winter. So he's like, oh yeah, for the, what would that be?
The levy?
Yeah, for the levy. Yeah. He was like, don't worry, I've got our food supply. I'm going to take care of it. It's going to be my mission through the darkest parts of winter.
or maybe it would be Tithe, I guess. But if it's about food, levy is the one at the end of winter. And it came up once in my game because it's about materials and crafted goods, and in my game there's like this Borg region that is contested between two holdings, and they produce all the peat for the realm, and so that created some kind of tension. I think most people will probably play through the Feast of the Sun because it's the first thing that they would encounter if they just start in spring.
I think it's also quite accessible. I think it'd be also pretty easy to have new players pop in to the realm, and you know, the Feast of the Sun is occurring, a day of excess and revelry.
It's a pretty relatable thing, like coming out of winter hibernation, and you're just like, ah, finally, get to go outside.
It's also a good way to give the kind of pagan vibes that Mythic Bastionland is going for.
Totally. It's funny that Scepter Mass is your favorite because that is the first player experience event that I've ever had. I have played as a knight exactly once, the first time back when it was Primeval Bastionland, and I've been running it ever since throughout all the versions. So a friend of mine offered to run a game for myself and a couple other people, and Scepter Mass is where we picked up, and the exact situation you mentioned of someone doesn't appear to Scepter Mass is like the source of all of the drama. So I think like from experiencing an event from both sides has been kind of fun because I've also run a Scepter Mass before, and I don't know, just in hearing us like talk about the different ways that people use the events, it's clear that like there's very intentional thought behind the fictional premise for each of these to give both ref and player like plentiful ammo, whether you're interacting with the event or like running things slightly off screen to then trickle in front of players later on. It's just, yeah.
If you're a referee who's just focused entirely on the myths and then you decide to run a festival, you're probably going to shift the focus a little bit towards the politics and those things. Just out of necessity, there's people hanging around, meeting different people. I think that the player's going to ask what's going on in the realm when you do that. But it does make me wonder, though, do any of you connect the festivals to the myths in any significant way? Because I haven't been doing that.
I can see Elder Mass being the moment where maybe the seers want to give you certain information, or where they step in and say, this is the most important one for us.
I'm curious, Jesse, you mentioned that you like running Elder Mass. So when there are these things decided in secrecy, how do you then share that information out?
It was, so I can speak to the most recent example, which was that one shot we did, which was like taking folks from one realm and pointing them at a cursed realm that has had so many bad things happen after the resolution of the dead myth. And so the seer that escorted them to that realm came as a representative from Elder Mass. So they didn't hear about Elder Mass like directly through direct interaction. It was through the kind of cryptic interpretation of this individual, and that then led to a lot of speculation in the session about like, do the seers have our best interest at heart, because we weren't necessarily there and this seer seems cool, they seem like a reasonable person, but the place that we ended up is nothing like what the pitch was up front, and chaos ensued and all that sort of stuff. For me, the using like a touch point in between the event that's a person to then color their interpretation of what happened is like really fun. But I think that's because the players in that particular group are very inquisitive and speculative. So that's a very easy sell for them. Whereas if I were looking for like a more goal-oriented group of players, it might be the kind of thing where we would pick up with their seers immediately leaving the event so that each of them got that seer's perspective on the group decision and whether or not those seers felt similarly to one another, whether they ended up on like opposite sides of the decision, because that sort of, okay, you have a goal, but now it kind of intersects in a prickly way with the other players in the group. That can also be really great ammo for play.
As a referee, do you change your prep, whatever it is, based on the speculation of your players? Would you say, oh, this is a great idea, now it is true?
Gotcha. Yeah, I think I've always been, since I came from story game world, at least initially, and have landed squarely in like whatever we're calling it now, the NSR, the hybrid thing where everybody's taking the best of both. Anytime I hear something that is too good to let go of, I will absolutely just go, yep, funny. There's like a section of the Oddpocrypha that even mentions this. Mm. Like, yeah, weird, huh? Right? Like you're accepting contradictions because you see a clear path to either something better or you've completely forgotten what the original concept was. Like, it's great. Yeah, that's a wonderful thing to do.
Do you guys think that the end of season stuff like tax, tithe, and levy will become more relevant when we reach like domain level play? Because at the moment, just what Jesse said, it rarely comes up because it's the end of the season and people tend to fast forward. And also whatever happens seems to be more on the organizational side of things.
I'm early in the Dominion play, but I do foresee that as being something that people will be interested in. Something that's come up very quickly is we have had some problems that they're dealing with, and they've been very quick to say, I send my best man to this part of the realm to deal with that, and I send another of my trusted men over here to do with this. And at the end of the session, I said, who are all these men they're getting sent everywhere? Where are they coming from? Do we need to have a conversation with this? So we've talked a bit of that kind of outside of the session itself, and definitely resources and personnel to some degree is going to become important. And I think paying for that stuff, depending on how detailed you want to get with it, I don't think we want to keep a spreadsheet of, you know, you're paying for 10 agents to be investigating things. I think the way to handle it is you say, you know, the tithe was poor this year and some of your trusted agents have now had to take work elsewhere. And, you know, you put the pressure on in gentle ways that are more story driven rather than tracking a bunch of numbers somewhere. But yeah, I think it's going to become important.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is about mistakes that you make that turn into like fruitful mistakes. Mm-hmm. So my players arrived at the realm at the Feast of the Sun, and I had this I had some kind of relationships between the holdings, and one of the relationships was that they supported the old king, and I had the whole preparation. And then when they reached the holding, I mistakenly had the wrong holding going on. And that turned into a secret organization that is now trying to overturn the...
They arrived in a holding. And
yes.
When you were consulting your notes, you were reading from a different holding.
I should have consulted my notes. I just... you know,
sounds like something I would do as well.
So it was the Feast of the Sun, and I thought, well, there were these banners of the old king, and I got the banners wrong as well. So I turned the crest that was the crest of the old king into a crest of a secret organization that is similar but different. And yeah. Now, like, I don't know, 20 sessions later, they have to fight the secret organization.
That's amazing and also really validating. If any of my players in my open table game are listening to this, spoiler alert right now, turn it off, skip forward. I swapped two myth keys at one point accidentally, and it was the perfect blend of the two. One was pulling from the worm and one was pulling from the demon, which had already kind of been melding into like similar sorts of, you know, just weird mutations and that kind of stuff. And because of the crossover, the players have correctly sussed out that both of them have similar agendas. And I was like, it would make sense for them to be allies now because they're clearly overlapping. And like, that wouldn't have happened if I had, you know, kept track of stuff. But now it's one of the most intriguing parts of the puzzle for them, is why these two entities are trying to do the things that they're doing. And that has, of course, led to prep on my end of, oh, that's a great question. Why are they doing that? So, yeah, mistakes can still be great.
It's one of the great things in the book that Chris gives us the permission to go with mistakes rather than, you know, in retrospect, change anything. Use it almost as a spark for improvisation. Yep. And for consequences that you haven't foreseen.
Yeah, synthesizing two things together is so much more fun than trying to like correctly hash out every little logistical thing. But again, that's my bias, which you can see in all of my blog posts.
I also find it's quite often some of my better omens are when I read the omen, we'll put it off to the side for 1 or 2 minutes as the game continues. And then when they trigger that omen, just, you know, whatever has lingered, that's what I'm going to run with. And then when I reread the omen, I'm like, oh, wow, I deviated quite substantially there. But often you get really cool stuff by doing that.
In your games, do spring and harvest feel different? We all agree probably winter is a different beast.
Spring and harvest feel quite different based off of their interactions with vassals and wildlife. Usually I think winter has a lot more ramifications for like the goings on of the council and, you know, hardships that are showing up. But usually, even just through like my own interpretation before the calendar was kind of put together, spring was kind of the messy season where the goings on of like people would spin up their initiatives and goals and really like pursue them aggressively, whereas harvest was much more of like a planning and politicking season. So apart from like the descriptors of the land, right, and the like atmospheric changes, typically spring tended to be more active and harvest tended to be more like, okay, now that all of the pieces are out there, what do we do with them?
I it's something I'd like to do better. I don't feel that they're very different in my game. I think winter, we can go into winter later, feels considerably different. But for me at the moment, spring and harvest, yeah, they're not standing out for me. There are times when it's relatively easy to travel and there's lots of stuff going on, but I want to work on that.
Maybe a suggestion, if you look at the calendar and the descriptions about the different months, they do give you a good feeling for flora and fauna, at least.
Yeah, I've done very little with the different seasons. In my long-term campaign, they started in spring and it kind of moved slowly towards summer. And yeah, in my one-shots, I've just mainly done spring because I find the aesthetic, the descriptions, that you can be so much more bold and vivid with like new sprouting plants. In that kind of sense, I find it more interesting to run. But I haven't really like dived into major differences between the seasons and having the game shift over time in that sense.
And did you have the feeling that your players were hesitant to advance time? That is something I sometimes see on the Discord, that people say, well, I'm coming from more traditional adventuring game, and for them it feels kind of artificial. Was that your experience?
It happened quite serendipitous, where we followed one myth. The players were really keen to like dive into the myths, like that element of the game. And once we finished the first myth, the second myth kind of started unraveling. And once we finished the second myth, the third myth was kind of unraveling. It felt very natural to just go from one to the next. So there wasn't really a sense that we needed to jump in that way, because the game was on the rails going from one myth to the next. And my players absolutely loved it.
And Jesse, you're coming from a more story game background, your players as well. For them, it's like fish in the water.
The current group that I have right now is actually, the open table is much more they have a much more like OSR background. So I think from their end, they're hesitant to let go of their agency to like control the situation. So most of the game took place in winter for that one. And then only recently has switched over to spring. And the way at least that I'm resolving stuff in between those seasons is just using that luck roll system, right? And discussing what the stakes of the various results for the luck roll would, could be for the ongoing situation. And it's, I don't think it's that they don't enjoy it. There's like, there's certain elements they want to be in place before the roll occurs. So I think they're playing like a very nuanced game on that front. Whereas folks that, like you said, have been coming from something like D&D, they're much more hesitant because they're like, oh no, like I'm not going to be able to exactly respond to whatever seasonal thing is about to take place. So I think depending on, it's weirdly enough, I don't think it's specific to the story game versus OSR or whatever that part of it. Usually it has to do with like how much the player has going on individually with their character that they are hesitant to let go of the reins. If they're like, oh yeah, I trust this NPC to take care of something, or I feel like we've put enough good stuff in place with all the goings on, then sure, let's go ahead and skip forward and see what happens. But if they feel even a little bit insecure about what's unfolding and they're like, oh no, it could go this way, then they're very like, no, 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 let's keep going, like week to week.
I'm curious. So you would use the unresolved situations role. Is that true? And can they then influence the likelihood or what is at stake when they prepare their?
Yeah, I've used both. I've used the set 1 to 3, 4 to 5, 6 results. I've also done like X and 6 just because that's a really good mechanic. Using that example earlier, the guy that made like worm protein and stuff for the vassals. We set that up as like an X and 6 chance. And then I asked him like, okay, what are the things that you do over the course of the winter in order to up that chance? And so he was like, oh, I'm going to pull in help from the marshal and we're going to go and consult one of the other players, weird seers, that domain kind of deals with food. You know, he put a lot of stuff on the line, so it bumped up the chance. And then of course he, you know, rolled well enough that congratulations, you made, you know, worm shakes for everybody for the winter. But I've also done, for stuff that's just like quick, I have used that set 1 to 3, 4 to 5, 6 distribution, and that's also been great. That one's a little nicer when things are very clear, like when there's a very clear path that this thing might take, as opposed to something where it's more kind of nebulous, and then the X and 6 stuff tends to feel a little more appropriate because then they can offer stuff that they do to up that chance.
But you could also in theory like change the stakes based on what they prepare. Now it's not whether the whole village starves, it's, you know, if it goes really badly, they are malnourished or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can shift all ends of it. And I've found most players, whether they're coming from, you know, more mechanical or more story game backgrounds, there, as long as that discussion is upfront, you know, that magic action procedure, everybody's totally down for it.
I would say the players are reluctant to move forward. Usually they're in the middle of something, they have some kind of activity or project they're working on. Usually we've moved forward when they've had a big win or when there's been a big result. And then we kind of feel, okay, let's skip on. Let's see what are the consequences of this battle or you know, resolving a myth or something. We want to see how that plays out. I think they primarily, like Jesse was saying, they don't want to feel like they're missing something. If they're heavily involved in some situation and then they hear it being handled in a montage, then I think they don't want to experience that.
Has that changed now that they have more experience with the game, or are they still hesitant?
Well, we did just do the 20-year jump or the age jump. And I think that's something that... I think that's a hugely important part of the game. I think if I was starting a new campaign, I would talk to people at the outset and say, this will be happening, and maybe plan for when it will happen. But I think it's good to play the game with... Because then the knight's traveling around thinking who is going to be my successor rather than where am I going to get better armor. You know, it's a different mindset.
Yeah.
So I'd definitely talk more about time up front Although I'm in a campaign that I think everyone is quite happy for this to run for as long as we're all having a good time. So we're not eager for everyone to just age out of action.
It's funny, there was someone on the Discord who mentioned that their knights rolled really well. And the first thing that came to mind, like, I have a big D&D of the 5th edition background. So when you hear that with that mindset, it's like, oh, cool, my character can do a lot. But I'm at the point where I've played enough Mythic Bastion then where I'm like, hey, I'd really like to play a knight who has gone on these epic myths. And he was clearly like the MVP. And now the heyday is kind of like behind him. And how's he gonna deal with that?
I think I was chatting with someone in the rules segment a little while ago, and I feel like I had always like known that the ethos was change, not like linear progression, right? Like superpower, power arc kind of stuff. But highlighting that, like, oh yeah, you could roll, you know, a super buff young knight right up front, and then as you change to a new age, the guarantee isn't that your stats go up, it's that they change, right? Maybe you get injured over the course of a tournament or on a quest that happens off screen or something, and now like you said, you know, the grand achievements are in the past, and now you're left with, you know, reality. Like, that's, especially for this kind of narrative, I think that's a really fascinating thing to look at, because it runs contrary to the popular trend, but offers just as many like rich mechanical opportunities for how you play the game.
Yeah, the funny thing also is when I said that, one of the comments was something along the lines of, why would you want to jump ahead when your knight is that amazing?
Yeah.
And I'm like, what do you mean? That's such a cool element of the game.
It's a different mindset that you need in order to enjoy the game fully. It's not, you know, playing to win, playing to have the coolest character, but yeah, kind of embracing the stories of chivalry. I mean, we will talk about domain level play as well, because that is one thing that I'm really, really excited about. Let's finish the kind of seasons. We also have winter, obviously. And winter is different because traveling is kind of discouraged, I would say. How has winter been in your longer campaigns?
So the open table game I've been running, we randomly rolled and started in winter. And then we proceeded to play in winter for most of the year. And it had such a unique coloring effect on the sessions that players really enjoyed. We had a lot of folks who were very into Soulsborne games, so they were like, oh good, the game is harder, wonderful, I'm here for it. But it offered a lot of really interesting choices, because kind of like we were talking about earlier, that sense of urgency to like grab hold of a situation and try to sort things out meant that they needed to make decisions between two horrible outcomes very often, right? Like, do I ride my horse to death, or do I put myself in a situation where if I get in a fight, I am more likely to die immediately? The rate at which stuff also rolls out, I know that's dependent on shelter and whether or not you're sleeping outside at night and all that kind of stuff. But we had so many critical decisions were around whether or not, like, oh, do we actively seek shelter because we could freeze out here? Or do we like power on and just make camp for the night and like hope that we get a good roll? It just created like a sense of urgency that I have not seen in the other seasons, that was cool for the situation that was unfolding with the plague myth, you know, like a sense of like there's a time limit on things that are spreading in the realm. So we really enjoyed it. Winter was rad. If difficult for the characters.
You were talking about the cursed realm that you sent your players to.
Yeah.
Is that inspired by your experience with winter, that traveling sucks?
Funnily enough, it happened in opposite order. So one of my first home games was centered in that realm. And when general of the dead, you know, like supplanted the ruler of the realm. Basically, I was like, well, this seems like a perfect excuse to have like an ice lich in a realm permanently frozen, right? So most of the spillover mythology and folklore that was coming from that realm was like an icy domain, right? So during the wintertime in the Open Tables realm, Harfall, a lot of speculation went on between vassals and NPCs and maybe a couple of knights on whether or not it was the effects of the neighboring realm spilling into their realm, or whether it was just the natural progression of things and it would like give an opportunity for that lich to kind of come in and start taking turf. So yeah, it's weirdly enough, not directly inspired by, but of course, as is always the case, linked. As soon as someone made the connection, I was like, yep, that's what's happening. True. Funny that that's happening.
And now that they started in winter, do they view winter as just another season where they would go out and travel and investigate the myths, seek out the myths? Or have they kind of found the rhythm of, well, maybe spring and harvest is the time to go out and seek the myths, and winter we should probably stay inside?
Yeah, I do think the latter. I think they are much more hesitant after after going through a full winter, just because they know like the way in which the game will push back on them as they try to do things. They're like, okay, now let's strategize now. Now that we've done the deep dive and survived the wilds in winter, maybe let's think about this next time.
We had a long winter. The players, because of the topic we talked about earlier of being reluctant to advance time, we stayed in winter for many sessions, and they just traveled around and dealt with the consequences. And those are hard consequences. Like it was interesting, and at times it meant some interesting thing would happen and they would ignore it because they didn't have the resources, the kind of the virtue to deal with it. So they would push on to a shelter or whatever they were doing. We do have in our realm two significant locations joined by a river. So there's a lot of travel by boat between those two locations. It makes things a little easier. I would say one of the more interesting things that happened with a winter context is I threw in the idea that part of the sea would freeze over in the winter, and there was an ongoing myth involving a sea monster. So they prepared this elaborate plan where they were going to go out onto the ice. They're going to prepare like an expedition, maybe have a warband, go out onto the ice and hunt the sea monster from land rather than having to do it from a boat. And that was a lot of fun preparing that.
That sounds rad.
It didn't happen because you know, random things happen and that monster showed up at a different time under different circumstances. But reacting to how the realm changes with the seasons, I think worked quite well.
Was that your only winter then in the campaign? So you had one winter and then at some stage you advanced the age?
Yeah. So we had one of each season. And now we've done a year and then we advanced the age. And I feel like the way it'll play out accidentally is that when the knights were young and stupid, they rode around during the winter. And probably now that they're mature, they'll probably hang out in the holding and get involved in drama, which I think is a nice, you know, that feels right.
So my experience with winter is completely different. They decided to stay put. And because of circumstances, they decided to spend winter in different holdings. So we had four players. One had to leave the realm because the king, the ruler, was actively hunting him. And the other three spent winter in different holdings. And I loved that so much. It was a play by post. So we had a lot of time to explore the politics of the realm, and that really pays off now at Septimus. When I see the comment on the Discord very often that people just say, well, winter is like hard mode, which is what Jesse said. I think it's kind of a lost opportunity to do what the game kind of implies. You know, you're not pushed to stay at a holding. You're not forced to stay in a holding, but you're kind of nudged towards it. I read the Pendragon rules, and Pendragon is definitely an inspiration for Mythic Bastionland. And there, obviously, they have rules for everything. You have 9 steps you have to go through in the winter phase, and you have to roll how fertile somebody is to have a baby and that kind of nonsense. But I think the general idea that it's a time for socializing is taken from Pendragon, and I'm kind of sad that none of you have experienced that side of the game.
I'm curious about one thing you said. So splitting up the party, to me, is always interesting when that happens and adds some kind of complexity for players and for the referee. But you also mentioned that someone moved to another realm. So did you run 2 realms at the same time?
No, that was actually quite funny. You know, all my players come from story game background, so he would just do a solo game. He would do a solo game where he journaled the journey to the other realm, and you know, he rolled randomly all the stuff, and he would put on the Discord. He would put his journaling entries while we were playing out the stuff in the holdings.
So I think rules as written, it takes a season to travel to another realm, and it takes a season to come back again. Did you use that?
Yes, that is a great segue, because I wanted to finish the topic of the seasons with between season actions, I think they're called, or what are they called?
Pursuits.
The pursuits, indeed. And so that player chose, their pursuit was pilgrimage, which is rules as written, or as written, it is learn about an unknown part of the realm, but we interpret it as leave the realm. Do you have any cool examples, interesting examples about these pursuits?
I think I already mentioned one of the ones that we had kind of used, that like worm protein shake thing. Most of the pursuits that people have used in between ages, they've been in the shorter games that I've run, and usually it's like, this may say more about my friends, like psychological tendencies, so take it with a grain of salt. Most of them were obsessed with like legacy and setting up not even like their own glory, but setting up their next knight of the same name. So that was like a very popular choice during age skips, of just like trying to figure out what they were going to do with the title later on. I realize I might have switched age and season, so I apologize for the topic jump. But even for like the season passing and then, you know, choosing a pursuit during that season skip, most of that stuff was focused on like community driven things. So I think during that same winter that one of the players was working on a food source, another one was focused on like, oh, I, as the Boulder Knight, I feel like I should go and like help with the fortifications of, you know, the keep, or I can't remember which bird knight it was. It might've been the pigeon, maybe the dove, I'm not sure, but they also focused on like bolstering the scouting capabilities of the holding during that time. So my experience with those time skips is that they're usually opportunities for the knights to do something layered into the community rather than their own pursuit. Whereas the stuff that's on that bigger scale of the age is usually like, oh, let me set up my successor.
Yeah, I'll begin just by saying that I really like the prompts in the book. So between the seasons and the ages, you have 3 suggestions for what to do. I think if you were just say to a player, you have time now, what do you do? It's extremely broad, but they kind of have a list to pick from, but it's so broad anyway. You can pick pilgrimage, and you can interpret that in many different ways, like going to another realm or going to a particular place in the realm that they want to, that they're interested in. Interesting things that my players have done. One of them set up a kind of a traveling troupe of, I think, a theater company, basically, to travel around the realm and spread stories about their victories, and kind of not for like out of egotism, but to unite the realm, because the realm was so divided, that like here are the stories of wondrous things that the people can achieve when they pull together. So they would give a version of events that was the people from these 2 holdings came together and defeated this creature. Someone raised a warband. Yeah, so I think in both cases, they're accruing a different type of power and moving slightly towards the Dominion play, where someone is getting resources that are a little bit beyond just a knight traveling around in person. But, you know, then when we get to the next season, they can say, during this season, I send my theater company to this part of the realm where they've lost faith in the ruler, and I give propaganda to support the ruler.
Sorry, I was going to ask you, like, is the warband now, like, traveling with that knight, or is it, like, in the background the whole time?
They raised the warband between seasons. In the next session, we traveled one hex to go on, like, a training exercise with the warband, because they were all just, like, farmers and stuff. And they were attacked by the Hydra, and half of the warband were killed.
Oh, no.
And that was great. It was so much fun. The survivors then are you know, heroes, obviously, and there's all the story about the great battle they had with the Hydra. But yeah, I mean, you can never plan for anything. We thought that would be march around in the wilderness a little bit, and then maybe they'll have like some. We were planning to have a kind of like a war game with another holding, where there would be two war bands fighting each other, but not in a lethal combat. So that's what we were building towards. Instead, they got eaten by a giant lizard.
I feel that, like, surprise of watching the stakes and the scale, like, shift drastically all of a sudden. I had a similar thing where the knights encountered an omen, I think it's from the tower, with the guards accompanying the giant birds, you know, flying with stones and stuff. And I was like, oh, they'll just meet these strangers and, you know, maybe like learn a couple rumors. Maybe they'll accompany them for a little while and then vanish. The knights used that opportunity to like try to undermine the goals of the tower. And they were like, hey, would you like to work for a better organization? Why don't you come and be our squires? And their party count went from like 5 to like 12 almost instantly. I was like, oh, we're half of a warband now. Scale is different now. and that has continued. Like, the squires have stuck with them. There is a certain weight of, okay, what is going to happen in between, you know, the accrual of a huge amount of new stuff and whether the season turns or the age turns or they just keep traveling. Like, you never know with the way that things roll out.
So in Jess's game, they were focusing between ages on their legacy. How was that in your game, Brian? What did they pick?
One of them focused on legacy. One of the knights married a seer and had a child with the seer. And that I think has a lot of potential for interesting things to come out later. One of them traveled to another realm to establish trade and diplomacy between the two realms. And the third also worked on legacy, but in a far more convoluted way, because that's his tendency, which is he's playing as the story knight. And rather than directly picking a successor, he has planted the seeds of stories around the realm. And there will come in the future kind of someone who responds to that story in a particular way. Like, their successor will naturally develop outside of their oversight. So at some point in the future, we'll probably encounter a young person who is their successor because they've laid this groundwork. We haven't really worked out the details of how that'll work.
So for the age skips, do you have NPCs that were, I don't know, like young squires and they are now powerful knights? Or NPCs that were old and died? Like, what was the effect on the NPCs, I think is the question.
Yeah, I have a spreadsheet with many NPCs in it, and I had to go line by line and increase the age of people. Because I was thinking about advancing time. So I was trying to introduce young characters. I was trying to have children present in the story more so than I probably would have if I wasn't thinking about that. And some of them have aged and become knights. And there's been one particular person that jumps out as someone who died of old age. But for the most part, it's probably young transitioning to mature and mature to old. So there weren't very many old characters, which I think in retrospect, that's probably another good thing to include. So have a lot of young characters who can age up, and then have old characters who you know that these are important people, and there will be like a power vacuum or something when they pass on.
Yeah, I think on my end, similarly, I have a huge Obsidian database with tons of fields populated with, their age. Usually what I'll do in addition to like increasing the age and then rolling to see if, do they pass in the night, that sort of thing. Usually I will try to like assign one of those luck rolls from earlier, usually just for my own sanity, since it's like usually a private thing. Not happening on screen in front of players. I'll stick with just the luck roll odds as is. And that has led to some pretty interesting situations, especially with the ruler of the realm, specifically for the open table game. Their trajectory out of another game of folks, because of course I'll use NPCs in between them and, their legacy continues. Their role from that previous age was the setup for that open table situation. So even treating them like little PCs and rolling for their progression, their how stuff has changed for them, which of those actions they chose, whether it was legacy or the realm or glory or whatever, even just asking a question of one of those prompts and then using that has been immensely helpful for me. And I, much like you were saying, I have a super young character that I'm sure there's going to be some weird stuff that will occur when they grow up. And I've also got an old coot who is way too much trouble for the realm right now. And everyone's just like waiting for him to die. They're like, please, like the age skip and the chance of him dying may save us the hassle of going out and fixing everything. So yeah, that can be super useful.
How was that in your games, by the way? Did the player say, let's have an age skip, or did you have to push them?
I suggested it several times, and each time they would completely say, no, we're having too much fun. We don't want to zoom ahead and miss things. And then eventually they suggested it to me. And at that point, I was surprised because I had thought I had felt the rhythm of where they were at with it. And I have a thought on it. I don't want to derail it, but I do have a thought about kind of GM neutrality, because there's a lot of things that had been set up during the first age, and then we're advancing them, and we did that quite collaboratively. We can talk about that if mm-hmm. we want to, but it can be hard if you get invested after many sessions in all these different characters, and it's as simple as a D6 roll. This character who you've spent seasons trying to... This is not great audio, but I can see Horst's reaction, and he's just going to be like...
I view all my NPCs through crosshairs. Let the dice decide. If they die, I will feel bad about it.
I'm just saying, I'm only human, And I wanted the ruler to live a good life after everything that had happened, and I want to see them flourish, and I think I rolled like a 3 or something, I don't know, and then you're like, okay, it's not so bad, not so good, things are, but that's it was a really cool experience though. We basically did 2 sessions of just discussing all these loose ends, and I rolled the luck rolls or the unresolved situation rolls openly, and we talked about how do we interpret these. For some of them, where it is a little bit more, maybe not all the information was available to the players, I just handled that myself. But for things where they had some knowledge of it and we were all comfortable discussing it, then we did that for most things. And it was really enjoyable.
Kind of on a tangent, maybe, the luck rolls. I had a pretty significant luck roll a couple of days ago on the Playbook Post. And they rolled a 2, which is pretty bad. But then I read it and it says, well, it's pretty bad. So I was thinking, like in PBTA terms, that is kind of a mixed success.
Mm-hmm. Something potentially bad, it says.
Yeah, something potentially bad. That seems to me like, I'm introducing definitely maybe 2 complications. But I'm not saying, whatever you try to do is doomed to fail. When you roll on somebody old dying, what is the D6 like?
For aging, it's actually, I think it's, is it like D6 vigor loss mm-hmm. for each age that passes? So you could potentially have someone live for many ages if you keep rolling ones. which I think would be interesting and feels mythic, you know, that you have old Merlin type character who people go to for advice and he's 300 years old.
That's basically like a seer character creation process, right?
Mm-hmm. And how did you decide on the age skip, Jesse? Was it you or was it the players or was it kind of both?
Honestly, it's been both. Like the number of games that I've run at this point, I feel like it's an even split. And I do think it kind of relates back to what we were talking about earlier, where the investment of the players in the ongoing threads and situations, like how secure they feel in all the pieces that they've put into play, is usually the deciding factor rather than like a style preference on their end. Because we would have some groups with, you know, a mix of different play styles so far as the players go, and they would opt to, yeah, let's do an age skip, no problem. And then the same exact composition with a different group, they would go, no. Like, there's no way we could possibly skip right now. And at least in my case, because of the structure of the open table game, the conversation of do we time skip and how much is always for the folks that show up that day. So when you end a session, there's always the acceptance of whether or not you will show up and like an age has skipped and your knight is now much older than the last time you picked them up. Whereas with games that are only running for like a dedicated group of people, we'll usually follow the procedure in the back of the book and do that at the end of the session and say, hey, what are we going to do this time? But it's never, for my part, it's never a recommendation of we're going to do this. It's always, All right, y'all pick what scale, if at all, are we going to skip?
And in the open table, like is it like West March's style? People show up and they tell you what they would like to do in advance.
People will show up and will accept that either, depending on the percentage of players that have appeared, if 50% of folks from an ongoing situation arrive, then they get the opportunity to choose, hey, do we want to pick up with another group elsewhere in the realm, or do we want to pick up with where y'all left off? And then because it's a mythic setting, that's very easy to invent excuses for mysterious knights to walk out of the fog. Either they'll get the choice of, cool, would you like to play a squire or another, you know, NPC or something that is already in the group? Or do we see your new knight mysteriously appear out of the fog? And most recently, we had one of the best scenes I think I've ever run, where a knight appeared in the waves of the ocean as another knight on his very first brand new, you know, green as can be mission, is like in a boat, you know, coming to shore, and he just looks down and sees like a knight in the waves and is like, oh my God, dude, come on, let's. And that's how they arrive, to see old friends of the knight that was in the water. So he's like, oh, hey guys, nice to see you. Doesn't explain anything about why he was in the ocean. Because of that like open structure, it offers a lot of cool opportunities for people to step into a familiar situation, at least as far as like the overarching realm goes. But when they are stepping in and who they're stepping in at is always, you know, dependent on the number of people that show up each time.
And when it's less than, like, let's say it's less than half, then you would...
new situation, I don't know. Yep.
New situation. Yep. And where would you start them? In a holding? In a dwelling?
Usually I'll ask what the players are most interested in. I usually have a couple of ideas for ongoing situations they could step into, just based off of the events that have happened in the game so far. Other times, if I'm feeling a little more mischievous, I'll just be like, yep, just rolling 2d12. That's the hex you start in. And then if other players are like, oh, I actually have an idea of, you know, like our company composition, and they all kind of collaboratively come up with something, then we'll pitch, okay, cool, let's start over here, because based off of the group that you've created, it makes the most sense to start in that particular spot. So it is kind of like a lot of the mechanics in Mythic Bastion Land, it's very opt-in.
I don't think I've ever felt more vindicated in my life, because as I'm playing more one-shots, I'm playing more and more to essentially what you just described here. So I feel like I'm doing something right with my game.
I can't remember where I heard it. I feel like it's in a blog or a podcast somewhere. But someone's talked about like, oh, the story isn't of individual characters. The story is like of the place, right, over time. And that has become a fascinating idea for me, and it makes it easy to do something like run a bunch of one-shots in a place with connecting themes, you know, that link between sessions, and then give you perfect ammo to be like, oh, we want to do a pickup game? Great. I've got a disaster over here we can step into.
Also, like, after playing, I think, 3 or 4 one-shots with just random people, it was really easy to kind of, like, get the feel for, like, the rhythm of the one-shots, and then how to add things that aren't just basically myths.
Yeah.
So things that they do in-game that kind of like, hey, this is just a little, you know, a side quest that they're ignoring. So that means that that's going to be a problem for the future.
Exactly.
And then building that out was actually quite, it was quite satisfying. Yeah.
Jesse, I have a question about your game, which might come down to me misinterpreting something on your blog.
Sure. But
do you have an idea where the knights can somehow summon their seers?
So that one I've kind of waffled back and forth on, depending on the situation. Looking back, I probably would have made it limited to the seers in the realm. But when I started the game, I was like, oh yeah, contacting your seer, totally an easy thing to do. There might be costs associated with it, right? Like virtue loss or sacrificing an item, or maybe it leads to a dangerous situation. But for most of the sessions so far, knights can contact their seers. And they're just as obtuse and obstinate as they would be if they're meeting them in person. So it's less helpful than I think they dreamed, that they're like, oh, I have the palant, you know, the orb of the Palantir, and I can just ask it questions whenever. No, it's so much worse than that. So they'll do it, but then that will lead to like kind of weird offshoot quests. And then they come back to a situation. Like, as an example, one of the players consulted their seer about, like, yo, which way do we go? Because we feel lost. There's so much going on. We kind of have analysis paralysis. And so when the seer appeared, it was the Sunlit Seer. And the Sunlit Seer has got, you know, tons of stuff around, like, the sun and their face appearing in the sun and showing them possible futures and all that kind of stuff. And one NPC faction had just, like, wandered into that hex. So the seer appears, notices, I even rolled for it. I was like, oh, maybe there's a chance that the seer doesn't notice this weird little demonic entity. Nope, 100% clocked it, turns her face towards it, singes it at the top of a mysterious spiral staircase. The knights hear the sound of this creature, like basically being burnt alive at the top of this thing. And they're like, we're not going to go up there. That seems bad. We're just going to ignore it. It's fine. And then like 3 sessions later, come back to it. And they're like, oh my God. There's something here. We have to interact with this. And now it's like they are now directly interacting with that weird demonic entity, having bounced off of it a couple of sessions beforehand. So yeah, the even just being able to summon and talk to a seer, even if it feels like it might be overpowered initially, if you just stick with like their weird desires and stuff, stick with the action procedure, you still end up in like prickly decision making territory, which has been really fun.
So you have the 4 seers in the realm, and they are not the ones on the like on the page with the knights.
Assume. Yeah. So there are additional seers in addition to the knights' seers that they can consult, which has caused drama.
I think that is one of the arguments of people who put the seers of their knights into the realm, that they say there's already some kind of established relationship and we can kind of use it to have interesting decisions.
Yeah.
I'm kind of in the other camp. I'm in the camp of I want the seers to be as weird as possible. There was one, I think it was a blog post where Chris described Jabba the Hutt as his, you know, the experience of seeing the movie for the first time.
Yep.
Obviously, even if they are the seer on the character sheet, the player will have that experience for the first time. But I don't know. I want them so weird and so kind of untouchable and obtuse that using the ones that knighted them feels kind of lessening that effect.
Yep. Yeah, it's... I've found that like it can kind of depend on the player's interpretation of their relationship with the seer, and it may just be the way that I'm running seers in general, but I feel like I end up very much in the situation you're talking about where they're so eager to do it the first time, and then the second time they're like, okay, do I really need to talk to my seer? And then usually by the third time they're like, I don't want to can we do anything else except talk to my seer, please? It's so weird every time.
Well, Jesse, I introduced you as a dabbler in mythic magic. Can you talk a little bit about, like, to me, it sounded almost like something like White Hack or, I don't know, Freebooters magic system. Where's the main inspiration? Is it RuneQuest?
There are a couple of different points going on here. One is that I do love RuneQuest as a setting, and I love the way in which it handles, like, doing really cool magical spells, but there being requirements of you socially in order to, like, reach that level of casting and everything. I thought that was really cool. I wanted something like that because in the background of all of the settings that I'm running, or all the realms that I'm running for Mythic Bastion Land, I wanted some kind of cohesive cosmology. And so RuneQuest captured my imagination. I was like, oh, it'd be really cool to run RuneQuest as the gods in the background of all these other different games that I'm running, and then I'll just run it through the filter of whatever that setting is. So, you know, something like Yelm is in both Mythic Bastion Land and Mothership, but looks very different depending on, you know, the situation. And then I was like, okay, well, I don't want to step super far outside of the mechanics of Mythic Bastion Land, because the core action procedure gives you so much room to do so much cool stuff that, like, is there a way that we can just keep that and bolt on some little specifics? And I think at the time I was reading the updates to Synthetic Dream Machine, Luca's backbone system for Ultraviolet Grasslands and Our Golden Age. And I was like, oh, I really like this just simple targeting system. I love how abstracted things become. So I guess you could say it came out of RuneQuest is the myth, the lore, staying within Mythic Bastion Land as the mechanical structure, and then only bolting on, like, little tiny mechanics from UVG.
I do remember playing RuneQuest, I want to say 30 years ago, so excuse me if my memory is a bit foggy. But it was, you were granted spells by your deity. Is that right?
That's correct.
And how is, and you put like a cosmology into Mythic Bastion Land, and the knights will have one deity that they pray to.
It would basically be like, you know, what is your seer aligned with one of the gods or the cults? That's like the main structure. Is like there's a group of people dedicated to the worship of a deity, a cult. And so the pursuit of, you know, discipline within that cult gets you access to the core runes, which you can use as kind of like a spark system for generating spells. So the setup would functionally be like, oh, who is your seer aligned with? And usually that's what would grant a knight the ability to, like, summon a rune or something like that. But as is the case with all Mythic Bastion Land stuff, I wanted to make sure it was really scary to do that. So I was like, okay, well, Vigor already has the scar system, and Guard and Vigor have the scar system, wounds, all that other stuff. It feels like clarity is kind of, it's a good stat to reach for in social situations or when people are trying to puzzle through something. So spirit to me felt like the one that was weighted, like there was room to kind of attach something to it. So, you know, using your spirit to conjure spells and stuff seemed to make a bunch of sense.
And you said, like sparking, is that like a spark table where you get, I don't know, nouns or something, and then they can create a spell?
Yeah, it would be associated with, like, the runes from RuneQuest. Obviously, you don't have to use the RuneQuest stuff if you don't want to, but it's an excuse to have something like fire, water, shadow, flame, truth, whatever, right? And so you could get really interesting combinations where there's still room for, like, player agency and collaboration to build something on the spot together. But you'd still get that bumper rails of starting off with, like, some finite elements To put, you know, some guardrails on the spell.
And I mentioned white hack because you also have something like duration, like effect level, mm-hmm. essentially. And I think, what was the third one?
Let's see. Oh, potency. Yeah.
And they roll, and how do they generate the points to spend?
Oh, it starts from a base location. So typically, if you're trying to cast a spell of some kind, you can do it right here, and it'll be a weak spell, and the magnitude is like you could do it to yourself or someone that you would touch. So every increase in the amount of spirit that you're spending to do a thing past that point bumps that up, right? Oh, it's not right here, it's over there. Or instead of it being a single target, it's, you know, a small group of people. So the more that you commit to doing whatever the thing is, the more spirit you spend, the greater the effect can be. And having those sliders of, you know, range as like something that costs something to your spirit, the thing you're trying to do, whether that's damage or something else, that's the potency, that's the element that you're trying to dial in and affect whatever that thing is. And then magnitude obviously being the number of things you're trying to do this to.
And you mentioned that it is also dangerous. So how do you gauge kind of what could go wrong?
Yeah, it's much like the setting the stakes for saves or any other action. Spirit reaching zero also has other effects that are kind of left open for interpretation. I think vigor zero is like one end of your knight kind of burning out, right? Which is like death or just exhaustion, depending on where that vigor loss comes from. And then at the other end, I was like, oh, it would make sense that like your essence, whatever connects you to the spiritual elements of the realm, if that also tanks, that there could be repercussions either with your cult, with you, your relationship to your seer, in the immediate situation, maybe you lose control of the spell. That's always, you know, the mishap table from like Troika and a bunch of other stuff. That's always
DCC
on the table, yeah. Right? But just having an excuse of, oh, cool, like you have drained your spirit and now weird things can happen. Right?
Is the cost related to the dice rolls? So like you have a 9 and a 4. Is the 9 then be reduced, like used for the effect level and also subtracted from one of the virtues?
Yeah, the amount, well, I guess it depends on when you're adding, what you're adding to the cost of the spell, because it's not just up to the dice that you roll, right? Like the gambit system. There is always that inner, you know, the only thing I can think of is the Super Saiyan moment where you decide, no, I'm going to overcharge the spell. where you could add
Stead burn and DCC.
Yeah. You could add that as an additional cost in terms of spirit. So there are like multiple ways. Obviously, the thing that you're doing is what would drain spirit in the first place. But then choosing like, okay, no, like I really want this to go a particular way. I'm now going to commit to spending more spirit in order to make this happen the way I want to. So yeah, it's a mixture of doing the actual spell casting and having that drain your spirit, choosing to then crank up the amount that you're going to, you know, affect whatever the spell is. And then on the other side of that, there's that little spirit save at the end that says, hey, can you keep doing this? Or did you deplete your stash, you know, for the day? Which again, I feel like is just, it's like the mirror of the gambits from the other side of, cool, are you able to save against this gambit that's happening to you? Or are you able to save against the cost of the spell that you have just summoned?
Yeah, it's cool that you also introduce another way to use the virtues almost like a resource. Like we had the discussion last time that for some people it seems that the game is almost too easy, that virtue loss is not appearing as often as it should be in order to make it relevant. For example, do you have the spirit, and how you recover the spirit is a cool role-playing moment. But if that never is reduced, that is kind of a wasted opportunity.
Yeah. I think this, like, for folks that want to lead into a little bit more of a mystical, magical sort of setting, this could be a really great opportunity to drain that score regularly and give them an excuse to go out and, you know, do their spirit refresh action more often. Because that to me, like, that has been the crux of the interesting choices in the game, is watching those scores fluctuate and then presenting a decision that is going to require you to test that number. That's endlessly entertaining. And I will say, for those that are, you know, like, oh yeah, the game seems way too easy, I have run plenty of one-offs with really buff knights just dead instantly. So I do feel like even though the statistics seem to indicate that when you have that high score, it's great, if you miss that first save, my guy, oh, it's bad news bears all the way around.
For people who are interested in the your magic system, where can they find it?
On my blog at beardmancerbungalow.blot.im.
How often do you find that your players use this magic system?
So my home game uses it quite a lot. They really enjoy all of the wild stuff that can happen with it. I have found that the open table tends to prefer that more kind of low fantasy sort of feel. So I haven't used it in that one yet. But usually it tends to be the knights who have like almost more limitations than abilities. I know that it's balance isn't necessarily a thing that a lot of people come to this game for, but when someone is like, oh, I'm just the weird quirky knight with my weird trinket and I rolled low for all of my scores, then I'll notice that players are asking like, hey, by the way, like, I heard about this magic system thing, can we try that out? Whereas, you know, the gilded knight, right, who rolls like 16 vigor and has a giant sword, is like, nah, I'm good, don't worry about it.
It's almost like a way that causes the game to be more balanced just by player behavior.
Well, I guess it depends on what the definition of balance is, right? Because what I always warn the players about is, hey, right now the gods are sleeping. If you bring this into the game, they will be, you know, having fitful fever dreams that might spill over into the setting. So they're like, oh, okay, I didn't realize, like, if we introduce this into the fiction, that changes what you're going to do. I'm like, yeah, 100%. So it usually, you know, I think the people that have asked to incorporate it are usually supported by the group, because they're like, oh yeah, more weird demons and gods and stuff for us to interact with. Yes, please, let's do it.
You have picked a situation for us to judge, to referee, in a segment we like to call You Be the Judge.
So the company has just come from triggering the fifth omen of the plague, where an infected crowd in a clearing does a ritual around a red tree stump. In our game, the plague has taken on some demonic possession and zombie-like qualities. So infected folks become hostile and dangerous the more the disease spreads. The knights opted to mount one of their squires to the back of one of their steeds and taunt the possessed mob to follow them to the nearby holding of Sundust Chapel, which of course was ruled by a very suspicious knight, Sir Morrigan. They were like, oh, we're going to go to the Sundust Chapel and Morrigan can handle this situation. We just have to outrun the baddies. So on the way to the chapel, traveling to the next hex, they triggered the last omen of the plague, seeing the burning village from a distance, about maybe a quarter of a mile away. They opt to ride around and past the village, bypassing it entirely, to make haste to Sundust Chapel. As a result, the village falls to the infected and burns like an infected immense pyre, creating a huge collection of black demonic smoke overhead. Again, because fire and the plague possess these like magical qualities in our game, the rising wall of smoke from the village took on a sinister and demonic aura and then hurtled towards the company as they're riding away from the infected mob towards Sundust Chapel. I likened it to an approaching tsunami to help clarify the scale of the thing that's following them. So the company makes for the chapel as quickly as possible, but they realize there are farmers still in their homes directly in the path of the approaching wall of demonic smoke stuff. So, some details for resolving this situation. The walls surrounding the chapel are warded by ancient magics, guarded by an almost seer called the All-Knower. The All-Knower possesses some strange counterspells and protective wards. They're accustomed to being the thing that stands between bad stuff and the inside of the Sundust Chapel. The approaching magic smoke and possessed folks are a new blight to the realm, so it's unclear whether or not the magic and wards of the All-Knower and the chapel will prevent this thing from, you know, sweeping in and causing a bunch of chaos. There are also so many possessed folks that they easily number a few warbands, too. The chapel is extremely low on guards, since most knights there have been sent out to hunt for raiders that have come from the north, and the most that they can measure or muster is a single scraggly warband. How would you tackle this situation? This can even be like broad strokes in terms of, well, here's the scenes I would set up, here's how I would handle the large scale combat, like whatever. But I'm intrigued because most of the game tends to focus on small individual interactions, and some of the most enjoyable moments, at least for me, have been these like large scale warband, multiple warband size situations. So what would y'all do?
That is a terrible situation that the knights are in.
It's
I have
so
to say.
Bad.
Just to ask a further question, you said that there is a essentially almost seer.
Mm-hmm. So powerful, but not quite at the level of a weirdo, all-powerful seer.
But are they at the level that they would have been able to expect something on this scale to have happened?
Yeah.
Because then, like, my initial inclination is that they would have known that this was going to happen, so the wards are at least strong enough to stop the entity from entering the walls.
Mm-hmm.
But that obviously, that's half the battle, because now you're being sieged by these, you know, these demonic entities.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were explaining it, I was reading the page, and you have purging knights, which I'm going to presume were eaten by the fire.
They became part of the force because they were possessed by the weird demonic stuff. So they've like, even if we didn't see them on screen in this exact situation, they are now elsewhere doing horrible stuff in the realm.
My initial thought was they have to be knights that are now leading these warbands, which is making the situation even more dire.
Yeah. Yep.
Another clarification for me. So there is this tsunami of demonic smoke coming mm-hmm. towards us, and there's people in the way of that. There's innocent people outside. They're not in the chapel. They're elsewhere. They're in small...
Correct. Yeah, the chapel's like surrounded by like a wall as well.
Okay.
So... innocents in the fields around the walls. The knights are like just barely ahead of the infected group and also just barely ahead of this wall of fog that's coming in behind them. So, you know, do they stop to help the farmers? If so, what do there? There's like a single warband of kind of, you know, just little vassals and their pikes.
I'll throw in a suggestion for how I'd handle this and let other people pick it apart or add to it or whatever. I think I would want to have a visualization of this. So I would have the chapel, the home warband, the guys approaching, maybe have some kind of rough zones to show distance. And I think I would introduce a clock for the approaching smoke. So they're being chased mm-hmm. By the infected. And they're just moving, and then, you know, we can watch them move, but then there's a clock for the weird presence that's coming, and throw it back to the players and say, you know, let them see how much time they have and see what they'll do with it.
Yeah. Love that.
I think the way that I would have it is that the almost seer would have called the farmers into the safety of the walled sanctuary, just because I know horse is going to hate this, but just because I think that's more dramatic. And then essentially, I wouldn't force my players to do it, but I would kind of expect that they're going to make their way towards the, you know, the walled sanctuary. And at that point, essentially start some kind of like siege that the demonic entity is like, essentially like prowling along the walls 24/7. And now have it that, you know, the party has to think of a way to get out of here. And maybe introduce some kind of because you really have like an almost seer. If the players ask for something like, hey, can the seer do this? Or, you know, does this, can the seer grant me magical fireball or something like that? You just roll d6 and, you know, there's a chance that, hey, yeah, they do have that.
Just like Brian, I would probably start with what is their intent in the situation when they're fleeing the tsunami and they're seeing the villagers. Do they want to rescue them? Then we can go down the action procedure and say, okay, what's their intent? What's the leverage? What is at danger? I would say the danger is probably that the smoke will engulf them before they can get the villagers out. I do also like the idea of the clock, that they have some kind of resource that they can now spend their actions on and say, okay, if we want to save the villagers, that's already three ticks of the clock. But probably making it like smaller scale and deciding per scene what is at stake and then going down the action procedure.
Yep.
How did you do it?
A little of both. The players obviously, you know, kicked it back to them, outlined the situation, gave them a clear options for what they might want to jump into. Some of them broke off from the company and galloped like full on, you know, exhausting their steeds. So we rolled some vigor loss for the horses as they went around to the farms to try to pick up those people. We were rolling every once in a while for how intensely the infected were pursuing them. So the group that broke off to follow them, which was, wasn't even insignificant. It was like half of them. I kept rolling really well for them chasing them. So I'm like, they're gaining on you. Like every single turn they would go to grab some more people, put them on their horses. I'd be like, they're really close now. It's getting so much worse. But then the other group broke off, and one knight in particular was like, oh, we got to use the magic system a little bit here. I'm going to pull out this mysterious bottle of, you know, serum that they've basically given him. Never answered the question of what was in this. So I rolled on a spark table of magical effects that I keep handy, and they got something like pain fog. So they threw it back towards the infected, engulfed in, you know, mist, basically likened it to like a bunch of blades floating in the air, slicing at whatever's inside of them. And so that was the thing that bought them enough time to ride to the front, get the farmers up there, because otherwise that large group would have intercepted the knights that broke off to go and help them. But it was cutting back and forth between clock-like elements, because I would keep every turn I would advance the proximity of, you know, the baddies to them. I didn't have like a clock necessarily, but we were using a depiction of the area and just measuring ranges, kind of like you were talking about. But then as they got just outside of the gate, I was like, okay, now is the dramatic moment to check to see, can the all-knower conjure the ward or not? And we gave it like a 1 in 6 chance because they were tired and there's a bunch of fictional reasons that maybe they're not so good at their job. Rolled a 1. They totally got it. So we had this like just cinematic level of the Star Wars shields from episode 1, the Gungans deploy like lowering across the wall as they're riding under the gate, you know, the fog rolling across this barrier and up and into the sky, and hearing like demonic screams and stuff kind of echo across the plains. So again, it was clock-like elements, using ranges to kind of determine reasonable amounts of actions for people to do in that time, and then waiting till the worst moment to go, okay, cool, here's the high stakes thing of whether or not the wards will hold.
Well, now I'm obviously interested in, so there was the siege of the chapel with a shield. Mm-hmm. How did it end?
The knight that ruled that holding took that little group out afterwards to go and clean up stuff after the fog had kind of dissipated over time. And that immediately led into some scenes of them scouting around to the south to find out like, oh, what happened to that village? Burned. Oh gosh, it looks like the plague has spread south from that location. There had already been some ongoing threads within the Sundust Chapel that immediately kicked up into weirdly more dangerous than that situation. So they were like, oh, this is great. Thanks for coming. We need to immediately go and hunt this demon steed that is haunting the hills to the north, like now, because they've stolen stuff from us. So it was one of those, there was a horrible choice of, do we stay and make sure the chapel is safe from whatever's going on with the plague, or do we go north to handle this other situation? And they were like, we trust you, knight in charge of the holding, you've got it. And then they just went north. So we don't actually know how things have been going for the village since that point.
One of the things that I really love about Mythic Bastion, and it has to do with time, which is over time, when all these myths had happened, the realm changes in a dramatic way. I don't know if the half of the realm is now dead because of the plague, or, you know, if you have myths that create gigantic lakes, or like a gigantic canyon going through the whole realm. What is the most dramatic change in your guys' realm that happened because of either omens or something else that occurred?
So this is about the forest myth. Spoiler alert. What happens in the forest is that there is a creature, something like an ent, who is trying to spread his forest across the realm. And the company in my game confronted him and defeated him. And they're about to kill him, and an NPC knight who had traveled with them encouraged them to show mercy, and they did. And what ended up happening was, rather than killing this tree creature, they established a group of soldiers who watch over him, and they've made an agreement with him. He can have his forest in this location, but he cannot expand it beyond a particular boundary. So now there is a living ancient being in the realm who I think will probably recur at some point, who has a lot of knowledge, but obviously his goals and his interests are completely different to the human realm. And the story knight, who has this ability of saying, here's two possibilities, one of them is true, one of them is false, gave two possibilities for how immortal beings behave. One of them is that if they have some small little domain, they're quite satisfied with it. And the other one is they can wait a long time for their revenge. Like, they've made an agreement with this guy, they don't know if he will honor it. And I think that's quite interesting. So we've got this little Glaburn's Forest area marked down the bottom of the map.
Funny you mentioned the forest, because mine is also the forest. That works out nicely. This was used in a one shot, so it was slightly different vibe, just in terms of the scale. But when they finally made their way to and confronted the fearmonger, it was more like a representation of the old ways, like the ways pre the seers of magic in the realm. And so the fearmonger offered the knights the choice of, we don't like the way that the seers are doing things now because they seem more caught up in their inter-seer drama than protecting the realm the way that those of old did. Would you become the next generation of seers? And so we went down the line of like,
oh, wow,
who accepts the offer of the fearmonger? Every single one of them did, except one who went around telling, like, I think you mentioned in one of your previous games, they went around like telling stories to unite the realm. One of them just went around telling the myths of his friends who became seers.
Cool. That's really cool.
And it's the implications of the fearmonger bargain were kind of left nebulous of, well, you can kind of choose to pursue it the way that you want to, but some of them definitely interpreted that as like, oh, we should go and get rid of the bad seers. Like, we should just clean house of the current generation. Some of them were like, no, we're going to go the subterfuge route and like slowly undermine them in their machinations elsewhere. But it was cool hearing everybody at the end of the session recap, like, okay, as time passes for you becoming a seer and like trying to make the realm better, what is the path that you take to do that? So mine was also the forest, because it, yeah, it basically turned into like the seer civil war kind of.
That's cool.
William, I do hope you also have picked the forest.
I recently did a two shots where one of the islands in my realm has a grayed land where the plants are growing healthy, but they're all gray. And it's some kind of curse that was on the land, but I never really worked out what it was. And in this two shot, my players were just kind of keen of finding out what was going on here. And I thought maybe there's got to be something to do with the mountain, but I thought during the sessions, I'll work it out. And I got the second omen from the beast, which has huge red eyes watching on the horizon. And I changed that to not be on the horizon, but coming from the mountain. And the mountain that they were heading towards, all of a sudden, like these eyes opened and these red eyes were staring at them. And that then inspired the second session where I made a site for that mountain where all the different locations were highly inspired by what it would be like to have like an amalgamation of human organs in a mountain. And that was just kind of like this indication of this mountain being alive. Yeah, so it happened. I might have got there by myself, but when that omen hits, it kind of like solidified for me, like, oh, this mountain is alive and this mountain is ill, and that's why the land is the way it is.
Wow, amazing.
That's super cool. Anything that personifies like something from nature, just sign me up.
Horst, do you have an example of a change in your realm?
Not really big ones. The biggest change has to do with the eye. So the prey seer, I guess, spoiler alert, has the their motivation is they want to be eaten by a big thing. And so they led the knights towards the myth hex, where the eye will sprout. And there was this congregation of the followers, the cultists of the eye, all around. The eye sprouted out of the ground and ate the prey seer. Now I had to introduce a new seer. Also, I want to mention where the eye was slain. Eventually, I placed the remnant of the eye is still there. It's like a perfectly round boulder, and I had the prey seer carry like a branch of the elder tree that one of my player characters then put into the boulder, and obviously through magic seer means there grew a tree out of the boulder, and the hex that was kind of desecrated and ill obviously sprouted flowers and so forth. That is the biggest change to the realm. So a seer died and something was left. Is that in your game as well, every time that a myth is resolved, that you have a ruin, like a new ruin? Because you have the four ruins that you are supposed to place. When they resolve a myth, I make sure, like I prepare almost, that there will be something that is left behind.
I don't remember if it's in the book, but I've definitely been doing that, of just like anytime a myth resolves, there's something left behind from it. I don't actually remember if it's in the book to do that.
I don't think so, but it does, like, it does feel kind of, like, feels kind of natural that, like, when such a monumentous event has taken place, that's, you know, leaving some kind of scar behind.
I think the fact that you have the ruins already in the book gave me the idea that, oh, well, the myths of the past left something behind, so the resolved myths from now should leave something behind as well.
Yeah, and I don't think it even has to always be, like, ruins in that category. One of the first one-shots I did was with the Wyvern myth, and it was close to a small dwelling. And they now, I don't know if they got rich because they like sold parts of the Wyvern, or they just told the stories and people wanted to come visit there or something. But they got essentially like a tourist bump for a while. And recently I did the Spectre myth, and it ended with the Spectre killing one of my knights. And I thought... The player, sorry, was very keen to have her deceased knight be the next spectre. And I said, it doesn't really make sense to me because it doesn't fit the personality, if you ask me. But then I thought about it for a while, and I'm like, nah, that's kind of lame. And then that happened at sea where they passed, and now the closest piece of land, there is like the ghost of the knight. And there's a side quest for anyone who visits her. She has like a final wish, and then after that it can end. So in that way, it doesn't always have to be like a ruin. I think there's a lot of other design space that's also really fun to work with.
Oh, that's super cool.
Well, the realm changes with the player's actions, with the myths being resolved, leaving ruins behind. Time passes. Once upon a time, four nerds met on the internet and talked about time in Mythic Bastionland. That was our third episode. I thank you all for listening. I thank Jesse for being an amazing guest. And I hope to see you all guys soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much.